From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, we hear from the state's lieutenant governor about how California plans to reopen its economy. And later, two teenagers from Clovis tell us what it's like to have a parent working in the ER during the pandemic. But first, Maria Hinojosa is a familiar name to NPR listeners. As the host of Latino USA, she shines a light on the experience of the Latinx community in America. And with the release of her memoir in September, Hinojosa will also share some more personal stories. We talked about her book and the challenges of reporting during a pandemic. She begins by sharing why she founded the nonprofit Futuro Media Group.
So 10 years ago, at this precise moment in time, April of 2010, and you might remember it was a depression, an economic depression, and the show where I had been working now on PBS that was founded by Bill Moyers was closing shop. And I was essentially out of a job. And I, you know, it was a scary time, different than the kind of scary we're living through now. But I remember thinking, like, am I going to, in this point in my career, go out and continue looking for work someplace else and seek to be, you know, given permission to do the stories that I wanted to do, you know, because in an editorial structure, you have an editor, you have a boss. You know, I was not a boss. I was not a senior editor. I was a correspondent. And something just happened where I just said, you know what, this is a moment to take inspiration from women in Hollywood, actually, who have created their own production companies to do their own theatrical work. And I said, why don't I do the same thing? And instead of doing theater or television, do journalism. Do the journalism that you want to do, the kind of create the newsroom that you always wanted to work in, and envision it. And so it was a matter of, you know, I was very frustrated. I didn't have work. And it basically just pushed me, this very immigrant side of me, which was like, you know, oh my God, wait, go on unemployment? What? That was just, you know, the fact that I would have to tell my father that, or, you know, I've been very, very blessed in my career that I haven't had to do that. I've always been able to find a way. And so this time it just meant that I was going to do it by myself and create this company as a nonprofit, because I never have been interested in making money off of journalism. I've always understood the public responsibility of journalism. And so that's how it was born. It was born out of a little bit of fear and frustration and also opportunity. I had learned now how to raise money for a nonprofit. And so I created Futuro Media. And the first thing we did was to take over the production of Latino USA and create a television series called America by the Numbers for PBS. And from that time, exactly 10 years ago, when we had a single funder and no office, no office at all, we are now 10 years in. We are expanding now. We've got another part of our company called Futuro Studios, which is a for-profit company. We are developing new programming. Our numbers are exploding on Latino USA. Even though we've been around for 26 years, our numbers are huge on NPR and digitally. And so at that time, I didn't know that I would be probably the only Latina running a nonprofit newsroom in the United States. I just did it because I needed to do it. And I'm really proud that with a tremendous amount of teamwork, I mean, I had the idea, I had the vision, but I did not do this alone. And yeah, now we're celebrating 10 years and a lot of successes.
What an incredible story, particularly at a time when we're seeing newsrooms contract and get smaller, and, you know, that you've had such incredible successes is just really inspiring and remarkable. So congratulations.
You know, a lot of it has to do with the fact that I, from very early on, you know, my understanding of journalism in this country as a Latina Mexican growing up on the south side of Chicago in the, you know, 60s and 70s and not really seeing myself represented anywhere, that, you know, made me think I could never be a journalist, was never good enough to be a journalist. Now you push that, you know, many decades forward, and what we decided to do was to create a company that is essentially, you know, created by a Latina, run by a Latina. My CEO and executive director is Erica Dilday. She's an African-American woman. The majority of our staff is non-white. Many of them, the majority, have direct ties to immigrant roots, or themselves are immigrants, or their families and parents. We are very proud of the work that we do in representing the LGBTQ trans community in our reporting. And so when you walk into our news, and by the way, You know, there are several white men who work with us who are very much an integral part of our company. And that's exactly what I wanted. I wanted us to look like the United States that I know, that I've seen as I've traveled across the country. And I always understood from way back when that it's not just about doing good representative journalism. I mean, that's essential. What you're also doing is you're guaranteeing an audience because people want to see and hear themselves. And so because of our journalism, that little girl who was me, you know, many, many decades ago, now they have a place, Futuro Media, where they can listen to In the Thick, or they can listen to Latino USA, or they can, you know, watch some of the programming that we, on a program that we're distributing through PBS, which is called Unladylike, Celebrating the 19th Amendment, 100 Years. We have so much journalism out there and people depend on it. So it really was a response to the demographics and to our responsibility as being representative, culturally competent journalists.
I would love for you to talk more about demographics, and particularly how the demographics of American journalists affect the way issues are covered.
Well, sadly, America's newsrooms and journalism as a profession is one of the more resistant to change. More resistant to change demographically. We all know the numbers. We see them. Even through NPR, we see the numbers where NPR will come out year after year and say, wow, well, we haven't really been able to make progress on, you know, elevating the number of Latinos and Latinas on our air. And it's like, why not? You know, so, you know, and that happens across America's newsrooms. So what we have to realize, and I don't like saying this, but it is true, right, that the majority of the news that everyone consumes in this country, whether it's television, I'm talking about mainstream, you know, television, radio, you know, the people at the top, at the highest levels of those networks are usually white men, heterosexual, of privilege, class privilege. And by the way, many of them are incredible human beings and incredible journalists. But if all of us are essentially seeing news through that senior editorial perspective, the one that decides what's going to be on the front page, what story is going to run, what the headline is going to say, then we have to realize that we're all being impacted by that. And what we're trying to do, and I think the success is, we're saying, well, we're very open about representing, you know, a POC perspective, a people of color perspective, a non-white perspective. And by the way, the majority of our audience, for example, of Latino USA on NPR is white. So the fact that we have the audience, Latinos and African Americans, but also hold the white audience to me, says that we're doing journalism that is giving people a sense of voice. But on the other side, people are learning and finding the commonality that they have with us in all of our stories. So I'm very, very proud of this work. And I stand on the shoulders, you know, when I get really frustrated or worried or scared, because, you know, running a small independent nonprofit media company is a challenge. I think to Frederick Douglass. I think to Ida B. Wells. I think to a woman named Jovita Idar that most people have never heard of, who is an American woman from El Paso, Texas, that helped run a newspaper. I am standing on their shoulders. There is a history of journalists of color and conscience in this country that I know I'm a part of, and I feel a tremendous responsibility to serve and to service. And in that sense, making people see themselves, to me, is adding to our democracy.
So I understand that you have a memoir coming up. Tell us a bit about it, and why now was the time for you to write it?
The name of the book is Once I Was You, A Memoir of Love and Hate in a Torn America. And I mean, I was working on this for over a year. The reason why this book was born was actually because the chair of our board of our nonprofit, Deepa Donde, she said to me, look, you have to write this book. It's called Illegal Is Not a Noun, which many people know that I went viral when I said this on MSNBC in 2016. And I talked about how this term illegal, it is not a noun. You don't use it to refer to a human being. It is an action. And so she just said, you know, you went viral. This is an important moment. You should write that book. And that book morphed into the idea of actually writing my own story, which morphed into not just my story, but rather really documenting. It's not just a personal memoir, which it is, and there's all of that emotional drama that's there, but we made it into a bigger book where we're talking about the history of immigration policy, my relationship with, for example, the first women who were excluded from this country by law. And people are like, who would they be? Well, it was Asian women. It was Chinese women who were not allowed by law into the United States before the Chinese Exclusion Act. They were the first ones, women, just like my mother, who wanted to come and be reunited with my father, who had moved to this country. So the memoir is also about my journey through feminism. I mean, I grew up in the 70s. But I was also raped in the 1970s. And so I come to terms with that experience of also being a Latina, a Mexican woman. The rape occurs in Mexico. So there's a lot of being a woman and my identity as Mexican and American. And also the journalism, you know, as a woman of color, as one of the first Latinas in many newsrooms, too many newsrooms. I also talk about what it's like to be in those newsrooms and experience covering stories from my perspective. And many times, you know, many times in my career, people saying, oh, you know what? You're just a little bit too close to that story. As devaluing, actually, the fact that I had extraordinary intelligence about, you name, you know, whether it was feminism or women's studies or being an immigrant or being Mexican or, you know, any number of things. Those were things that actually made me a better journalist. So a lot, that's all together in the memoir. So it's been a labor of love, and I'm so happy that we were finally able to announce it.
So I'd like to switch gears and talk about, you know, the issue that's on everyone's mind right now, which of course is the coronavirus. What are some of the challenges of covering the impact of this pandemic on our most vulnerable populations?
I mean, look, right now the challenge of covering this is, how are we talking to people? You know, we certainly don't want to be sending our reporters out onto the street. So we, you know, one of the first stories that we did, we got access to the largest free health clinic in the United States. It's based in Chicago. And over the summer, we did a documentary about that health clinic. Most of the patients there are undocumented. You can only go if you are uninsured. And so we went back and made calls to the patients that we had met who are vulnerable communities. And we were able to put their stories on the air. In the first week, once we had shut down the office, we were already putting these stories on the air to give voice to what this looks like. We were at that point still able to interview people on the street who were working. I mean, I have seen day laborers. I look out my apartment window here in Harlem in New York City. And what do I see? I see Latino men on bikes delivering food. You know, I go to the grocery store in my community, and who do I see? Dominicans working in the bodega, that is, you know, the supermarket that is serving our community. I'd see women who were nannies taking care of children in the park. So for me, these are people who continue to be uninvisible, even though now, as we know, we are depending on them to survive. I think for me, the other, very early on, like in the beginning of March, when I was about to go on a bunch of plane trips, and by now we, you know, everybody was clear that this was a very scary time because of COVID-19. And I remember saying, you know, now when you walk out of your house, your car, you know, you feel like you're taking your life in your hands. You're not sure who you're going to interact with, what doorknob you may touch and then touch your eye without realizing it. You're walking with your heart in your hands. I said, this is the way undocumented people live every single day of their lives. Every single day of their lives, they walk out of their home and they take their heart in their hands, not knowing if that day they will interact with the police, who then decide that they're going to be handed over to ICE and then deported. And so for me, this has been a very important time in this country, really seeing themselves in each other and really seeing how much we depend on the people that at least, you know, many politicians, at least in this administration, seem to deem as less than, less worthy, coming from, you know, S-hole countries. And yet these are the people who we are depending on.
So one part of this that we've been following here in the Central Valley, and I know this is an issue all across the country, is the fight to release immigrant detainees in order to mitigate the outbreak in detention centers. What are you hearing on that particular issue?
It's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. We're doing a special report, I think it drops this week, with Mother Jones that is looking exactly at this problem. So here's the worst kind of a situation where you have immigrants, and the majority of these immigrants are not criminals. And when I mean criminals, you know, the administration, whether it was Bush, whether it was Bill Clinton, whether it was Barack Obama or now Trump, they will say, well, we are just taking the criminals and putting them in these detention facilities. Anybody who has committed fraud as an undocumented immigrant could be considered a criminal. So we have to understand that these are the people who are being held. If there was anybody who was a mass murderer or a rapist, you can be sure that those people have already been taken and deported. And that means that if there are mass murderers and rapists, you know, who are immigrants running around our country, we don't have an immigration problem. We have a policing problem. So understand that the people who are being held here do not have to be held. Many, many, many of them have green cards. They may have committed a crime 20 years ago, like selling a joint, and now they're being picked up and being processed for deportation. So these are people who are educated. They know, because of past protests, you know, they do have televisions now, which run news channels. They are watching the news and they're hearing what's happening, and they're getting very altered and anxious. And in the case of a detention facility in Louisiana, you know, they started to protest and they started to raise their voices in community protest inside the detention facilities. And what did the agents and guards do? They pepper sprayed them. What is the worst possible thing to be doing in a pandemic with something like COVID-19 is to put people together in a room where they are coughing on each other. And this is what they have done more than once. So the call is to set them free, because when this takes off in a detention facility where people are, let's say, 75 people in an enclosed room with no windows, we're talking about a death trap. And we've already had deaths in ICE detention facilities. So many children have died. Children, you know, elderly. We did a story about a man who committed suicide when he was under suicide watch. So deaths have been already happening. But with this, this is going to be a loss of life like we can't even fathom. And because of the decades of work to dehumanize these populations, the perspective will be just, well, they shouldn't have been here. Well, it's their fault. Well, aren't they illegal anyway? So this is a desperate humanitarian moment. And I'm hoping that activists are able to get their message across, although sadly, I don't have any hope that this administration will heed the call. And by the way, there will be guards and ICE agents and Border Patrol who also die because of this. So there's, I would hope, a sense of self-interest, and that whistleblowers come forward to tell the truth of what's happening inside these detention facilities.
We are, of course, in the midst of a U.S. census. Can you speak to how important the census count is, particularly for the Latinx community, and how COVID-19 is impacting it?
Yeah, this is very scary for a lot of people. And so first, I want to acknowledge that people feel uncomfortable about the census. I need to acknowledge that, and I understand. And then I need to say, we need to swallow that discomfort. And we need to understand that the importance of the community right now is what matters. And you will be safe, and your information will be safe, and we will protect you. We need to recognize that right now, with this administration, it is very difficult for people to trust the federal government. And we need to acknowledge that. And that is not the people's fault. That is the fault of this administration and past administrations, and administrations that, you know, provided the government with the names and addresses of Japanese Americans who were then put into camps. Not internment camps, I don't even know what that is. They were imprisoned against their will and they were innocent. And that information came from the census. We will not let that happen again. And so we need to believe and understand that we will be protected, that our information will be safe, that if something happens, you know, there will be organizations that come to defend you, but that what we need to do is to participate and to answer. I already did my census. It was one of the first things I did in the first week of isolation here in New York City, and I felt so good to click send. You know, I did it online. I would urge people to try to do it online. It's the easiest thing. It's less than 10 minutes. Get your kids to do it with you so that they can see what the process is like, so that they learn that in 10 years, they're going to have to do this themselves and that they have to, because it is our responsibility. So do it because we have to, and do it as an act of civic duty, no matter if you're a citizen or not.
Well, Marie Hinojosa, it is an absolute delight to talk with you today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And thank you to everybody in Central California. I really do appreciate the work that you're doing every single day to feed the rest of us. So I'm very, very, very thankful for every single one of you who are working every day and who are listening to this show. And I love you a lot. Big hugs from quarantine in New York